I think we're ready to start. First of all, an announcement on the MP3s. Greg has them with him, the third and last of the MP3s for this course.
Money.
On an lecture on understanding and being in 1958. Lectures on insight, which became the book Understanding and Being. In terms of what we're covering right now, those MP3s cover the dates of August 13th, August 14th, and August 15th, 1958. And in terms of what we're covering right now, the first one of them is August, the first of the MP3s is August 13th, part two of the lecture. Unfortunately, there was a mistake or there was an error made, and part one of that lecture was not recorded. And you'll notice that even if you look in the book, chapter 8 in Understanding and Being, that the first part of the chapter was put together from notes of Fred Crow and Willie Stewart, William Fudd Stewart. But that's the first two sections. So picking up part two then would cover a good deal of the material that we saw last week. In terms of the book, Understanding and Being, it's chapter 8. Beginning with section 3. You might want to read sections 1 and 2, but there is no recording of sections 1 and 2. The text, the pages for that is 188 to 199. So that's basically last week. And then also, another August 13th is on the MP3, there are two question and answer sessions where people are conducting discussions with Lonergan. The August 13th question and answer sessions 1 and 2 are both relevant to the material that we covered last week and that we're covering now. And then in terms of what we are going to take today, August 1st, August 14th, part 1 is relevant to what we're going to see today. In the book, that's pages, if you want to read the book, Understanding and Being, it's pages 200 to 212. And then, so that's what's relevant to the material that we're covering today. August 14th, part 2, will be relevant to chapters 16 and 17. We've got a week before we get to chapter 16, because we have another part of chapter 15 to cover in class. So this is what you need if you're going to be following along with the audio. August 13th, part 2, both of the question and answer sessions, and August 14th, part 1. Are relevant to this material. Okay. I don't know whether you've had a chance to listen to any of the question and answer sessions from. Are they on the earlier MP3s as well? Okay, then you have, because there are some interesting things that come up. And there's a marvelous thing on suffering in one of these. I'm not sure that it's this one or if it's the next one. I think it is this one, because these are the last discussions, aren't they? So it's in there. But all of a sudden, somebody just asked him about, well, how do you, if there's a good God, how do you deal with suffering? And he just went out, just very quietly for, I think at least 10 minutes. And it was something quite extraordinary piece of theology and spirituality. You see another full side to the man as he was speaking there at that point. It's quite wonderful. So much so that they applauded him at the end of his 10 minutes. It was just like one of these things. Nobody expects Lonergan to talk piously, but he did very much so. Right, so. All right. Actually, you do after you read Bethlehem Theology, but in insight, you don't think of them that way. So much so that in Method and Theology, that Pattenberg, who really didn't know much about Lonergan prior to reviewing Method and Theology, called him a pietist, which is about as far as you could get from the truth. All right, now what I want to do is to go back, first of all, to some of the material from the notes of last week, because we did not finish. And where I want to start on page 7 from the notes from last week. Does everybody have the notes from last week? Robin, did you?
That's my phone.
That's it? Anybody else need them? We got down to, we covered sections 1 and 2 of the chapter, which is down to number 25. But we've got to take the material that's on there about section 3, because that's what leads right into what we're doing now. So So section 3 of chapter 14, this is on page 7, number 25 of last week's notes. Section 3 treats method in metaphysics. How does one reach such an explicit metaphysics? Remember that the process is one of elevating the latent metaphysics of the human mind, which is present in the very fact that our knowing proceeds from experience to understanding to judgment, always. How does one elevate that to explicit metaphysics so that you have not only an integration of the knower, but an integration of what the knower knows, which is what metaphysics is all about, an integration of the known. How does one reach? What's the method? What directives can guide one toward an explicit metaphysics? Well, number one, the starting point, as with anything else in the concrete learning process, is people as they are. Start with your own mind and the minds of those that you want to talk to about this as it is, and start exploring it. More specifically, the starting point is yourself as you are. You've got to start there. Explicit metaphysics can exist only in the empirical, intellectual, and rational consciousness of the self-affirming subject. And so the first thing is to see whether or not you can affirm for yourself that you are a concrete unity identity whole whose cognitive activities unfold on these three levels of experience, understanding, and judgment. And become as familiar with that as you possibly can. We'll see this more when he gets into interpretation. The more you know yourself, the more you are familiar with the operations of experience and understanding and judging, the more likely you are to be able to understand what comes out of the experiencing, understanding, and judging of another human being. So start with that and explore it, push it for all it's worth, come to know yourself in as precise and as nuanced a fashion as you can. So metaphysics can exist only in such a subject. It does not exist in a book. All that exists in a book is black marks on white paper. It exists in a mind. And only a mind can find something more than black marks on white paper. Book. Only a mind can find in a book the expression of another mind. So it doesn't exist in the book but in a mind, and it is produced only by the mind in which it exists. A book can help, but it has to be, it's a personal development that is at stake here. It begins in minds that exist, and it proceeds from their actual texture and complexion. Number two, but as I am, I cannot avoid experience unless I sleep all the time. And even then, I can't prevent myself from having dreams, which is an element of experience. So I can't avoid experience. I can't put off my intelligence. I do want to understand. And I do, you know, I will question things. And if I think I'm hearing nonsense, there'll be a little voice inside me that says that's nonsense, and so on and so forth. I can't put off my intelligence. I can't renounce my reasonableness without negating my own being. But what I need to do is advert to these inevitabilities. Advert to them and acknowledge them as very, not uniquely, not thoroughly constitutive of what I am, because there's certainly more to me than that, but that these are crucial to my identity as a human being. I have to distinguish between them sharply. So that experiencing is not the same as understanding. Understanding adds further to the content of knowing beyond experience, because it grasps a form or an intelligibility in what is experienced. So it adds something to it. So the differentiation that it took centuries finally to culminate in Plato's discovery that the world of theory is something different, and the operations involved in theoretical knowledge are something different from sense experience, a sharp differentiation. So to discern, to distinguish between them sharply, and then to distinguish that judgment is something different from understanding. Judgment is an assent. Understanding, you can understand ad infinitum without assenting to anything. Discern the immanent order that binds them together, so that, for instance, understanding always is understanding on data. Judgment is always a judgment upon what I have understood. To jump from experience to judgment without understanding is not very wise. To pass judgment on what I don't understand is really not cognitive authenticity. shall discern that imminent order that binds them together. Find in them a dynamic structure that generates science and common sense. Acknowledge in that structure a normative principle. Normative, this is normative for truth. Follow this. This is the only way in which I arrive at truth, aside from faith, which is something that he will take up in the last chapter. Faith can also bring me to truth, and it's a whole different set of dynamics. But when we're talking about imminently generated knowledge, this is the only way I get there. So there's something normative about it. It governs the outcome of inquiry. I have to discover equally powerful but distorting dynamic structures in myself. The desire to hide from the truth, the desire to cover over, to come up with a cover story, to run from things that I don't want to discover. Or perhaps at times it's just intellectual laziness. You know, I just don't really know what to put in the energy that it takes. But whatever. There is a running, there is a flight from understanding as well. And there are dynamic structures that lead in that direction. And acknowledge the polymorphism of my own consciousness. So I need to undertake a process to self-knowledge. I begin with the desire to know as existing and operative. I move to the self-affirmation of the subject and the notions of being and objectivity. And once I do that, I can see, and you've seen it at this point, and you're actually getting through the chapter on objectivity, that maybe some changes have to be made in some of our common sense judgments. You know, if we think, for instance, that common sense is only competent and that we don't need theory, even for the well-being of the human race, well, we do. You know, we do need it. To take the ecological crisis as a beginning point. We need theory in order to save the earth. There's a science that has to be developed and applied. I mean, even for something that is that practical, the need for theoretical work is extremely important. And it's only general bias that will pull you away from that. Or to say, pull us away and say, well, we don't need to pay any attention to the environmental scientists and all that sort of thing. Well, we do. We have to have a way, of course, of screening, but discerning what they're saying, but it is an important thing. I'm just giving an example there of how their general bias can take us away from. So changes may have to be made in the fields of common sense and the field of my scientific knowledge, insofar as they're not purely and simply the product of experience, intelligent grasp, and reasonable affirmation. Now those changes are what he calls the reorientation. Which is one of the things that metaphysics as an integration of the known will do. It will reorient, at times, science and common sense. In my own work, particularly in the book Psychic Conversion and Theological Foundation, the subtitle is Toward the Reorientation of the Human Sciences. And basing myself in modern and starting with a reorientation of depth psychology by uniting what depth psychology studies with the operations that Lonergan studies. There will be a reorientation there. At the same time, it will complement Lonergan and develop his own work. But there's a reorientation then that has to take place in some scientific knowledge. And from there, from reorientation, I can move on to an integration. And we'll see some of this today when we get into the section in chapter 15. On explanatory gender and species. Again, a theme picked up from the chapter on things, but now placed within the metaphysical context. That's where he begins to develop the notion of the integration of what is known and to be known of the universe of proportional being. Okay, now, the integration. What is the key factor? And this is the reason that I insisted that we go back and start with this material from chapter 14 before going into 15. The key factor in all of this is the isomorphism that obtains between knowing and the known. Isomorphism means equal or similar in form. Morphe, Greek root for form. Esos, similar or actually really means identical or equal. There is a parallel form parallel form, the isomorphism of knowing and known. And I'm going to fill in this as a chart up here as we go along. The isomorphism that obtains between the structure of knowing and the structure of the known. So on page 424, he says, and this is the example of an analytic principle. If you remember back in chapter 10, he spoke about different kinds of judgment, and he mentioned analytic principle, and I said, well, we won't discuss that too much until we actually get to one, and this is the one that I was thinking of at that point. If the knowing consists of a related set of acts, and the known is the related set of contents of these acts, then the pattern of the relations between the acts is similar in form to the pattern of the relations between the contents of the act. Now, that could be just an analytic proposition if it was just a matter of defining terms in a certain way. But remember that an analytic proposition becomes an analytic principle if the terms that you're defining can also be affirmed in concrete judgments of fact. And here we can say, well, knowing does consist of a related set of acts. And the known has to be the related set of contents of those acts. So the pattern of the relations between the acts must be similar in form to the pattern of the relations between the contents of the act. That's the principle of the isomorphism of knowing and known. If every instance of knowing proportionate being consists of a unification of experience understanding and judgment, then every instance of known proportionate being, these are the operations, these are what the operations know, must involve a parallel unification of a content of experience, a content of understanding, which is not the same as the content of experience. Grasping and intelligibility is not the same as seeing a color. It's different. And a content of judgment. That's the analytic principle, the analytic statement of the parallelism of knowing and known, the isomorphism of knowing and known. So this is the simplest of the structures. So, and reoriented science and common sense will be integrated in light of these principles, and that we will begin to see in the next chapter, in chapter 15, which is what we're principally devoting ourselves to today. So again, number 29, every instance of knowing proportionate being is a unification of experiencing, understanding, and judging. And so every instance of known proportionate being will be a parallel unification of, part of it will come from experience, the content, part of the content will be contributed by experience, part of the content contributed by understanding, part of the content contributed by judgment. This is the integrating structure. Reoriented science and common sense will provide the materials to be integrated. We'll see more on that later. And it's the actual integration that will give rise to explicit metaphysics. And I think that's all that I need to take out of this, out of that chapter, that much. And then we'll get into the other things from chapter 15. So if I could pause for a minute for questions, but let's leave out, if we could, what I'm going to put here. So just this, that if there's anything on this that is needs clarification. The parallelism of knowing and knowing, the structure, the structure of the knowing, because the known is the content of the operations. If you've got the operations in that structure, the content has to have an isomorphism, has to have a structure that is isomorphic. Yes,
for me. Going back to the paper on elemental meaning, the experience itself has some content already before. So there is the elemental meaning in the experience.
Yeah. Okay. Can I take that up when I get into the what the actual content? Chapter 15 tells us what the act. What this is just analytic parallelism to this. But in chapter 15, he fills it out. He gives you more details. And I'd like to, if I could read that for. I mean, in another 10 minutes, I'll probably read that. But otherwise, I think it's confusing. So if I dealt with it. Okay. All right. So then we'll move to the new note for chapter 15. The problem of chapter 15 is to work out the basic structure of the note that is isomorphic with the structure of knowing. So it's not enough just to say this. I mean, this you can't stop there. That's like almost like saying it's almost a tautology. It's not. It isn't exactly, but it's pretty close to it. So we have to work it out more. Well, what is that content? What is the content of experience? What is the content of understanding? What is the content of judgment? Chapter 14 outlined the program. That's it, right there. Chapter 15 turns to its execution. And this was what will lead to the integration of the cognitional object, the overcoming of the fragmentation of knowledge, the broad lines of all that can be understood, just as chapter 11 led to the integration of the cognitional subject, you and me as knowers. So as he says at the beginning, thoroughly understand what it is to understand, and you will understand the broad outlines of everything there is to be understood. Thoroughly understand this, and you'll have the broad outlines of this. So the basic elements in terms of which reoriented science and common sense will be integrated are derived from this isomorphism. I said that already. Number two, metaphysics, as the integral heuristic structure of proportionate being, envisages an indefinitely remote future when the whole of proportionate being will be understood. And what it does, it asks what can be known here and now of that future explanation. It answers that the structure of that full explanatory knowledge can be known now. So the structure of it can be known now. More specifically, proportionate being is whatever is to be known by presentation. These are just other words for the same thing. Presentation, intelligent grasp, reasonable affirmation. What can be known now of that future explanation of everything? Well, we skip a sentence here because, let's not skip a sentence. Only one of these components, only one of these contents is unknown. The content of understanding. The content of intelligent explanatory grasp of proportionate being remains unknown, or it remains hypothetical, subject to revision, with the possibility of new basic terms and so on, until full explanation, or what later will be called the idea of being, is reached. So we know a lot, the sciences know a lot, and most of it is probably true, because it's been verified directly and indirectly, that there's always the possibility that there will be some kind of substantial revision in which the basic terms of physics or chemistry or biology or what have you will be transformed. It will have to carry forward what has proven worthwhile up to this point, and yet there's always the possibility of a fundamental revision of the basic terms and relations of the science. So until science knows everything, complete explanation of all phenomena, there's a certain question mark that can be put at this level with regard to the content of understanding. In this sense, that whatever is at that level, with the exception of the kinds of things that he took in chapter 11, is subject to revision, is provisional as explanatory understanding. Now, there are many other things that are not provisional. I am touching this desk. That judgment is not provisional. I am touching it right now. There's enough evidence for me to affirm that. He's talking here about explanatory understanding. Explanatory understanding remains provisional whenever the data that are explained are the data of sense. If the data are the data of consciousness, you can reach certain judgments that he would maintain are not subject to fundamental revision. But if you're talking about the data of sense, you will have, there is always the possibility, and the scientists will tell you this, what we have now is the best available scientific opinion of our time. They don't claim anything more than that. So we already know that the determination reached by reasonable affirmation will be the virtually unconditioned yes. It will be affirmation. It will be yes. It will be assent. So the content there, we know that. All that, that's what it is. That's what judgment has to offer that is different from understanding, that differentiates it from understanding. And we already know that the content of experience that will survive in fully explanatory knowledge is precisely the kind of thing he spoke about in those dreaded first five chapters of the book, the intellectually patterned experience of the empirical residue. And now we can see the importance for philosophy of his treatment of science in those first five chapters. Individuality, merely empirical difference with place and time, continuity, the continuum. He didn't say much about the continuum in those early chapters, but he brings it in here, spatial temporal continuum. Coincidental conjunctions and successions. And non-systematic divergence. Non-systematic divergence from intelligible norms. So that the kinds of things that he spoke about in chapters 1 through 4, basically, in terms of leading up to his theory of emergent probability. All of that now becomes the content of experience, the individuality, there's this and that and that and that and this and so on. The individuality, the continuum, spatial-temporal continuum, continuum of space and time, conjunctions and successions, coincidental conjunctions and successions, and non-systematic divergence from probabilities, which are just residue, empirical residue. But they do survive. Okay, so those are the contents. I'll come to Bernard's question in a moment, but it does introduce further complications. So let's get what Bernard says first. Okay, metaphysical elements, potency, denotes the component to be known by intellectually patterned experience of the empirical resident. So notice the major transformation that he's making now on the Aristotelian Thomist notion of potency. I don't think it's out of continuity, but look how he's able to bring it into a scientific context that Aristotle and Aquinas knew nothing about. Potency is, this is potency. Individuality, continuity, conjunction, succession, non-systematic divergence. Potency for what? Potency for form. Non-systematic divergences from probabilities are the potency for the emergence of a new scheme of recurrence. The new scheme of recurrence is now called form. That's what form is. Again, the Aristotelian Thomist notion, but now understood in the context of modern science. Form is what is known by explanatory science. Form is not known by descriptive knowing. The sciences know form. Philosophy only knows that there is form, doesn't know what it is, except the form of the human person of experiencing, understanding, judging. But the forms of anything else, that those are known by the sciences whose proper task it is to study those other things. So potency for form. So form denotes the component of proportionate being to be known by explanation, by understanding things fully in their relations to one another. And act is the metaphysical term for what I know when I say yes. When I say yes, that's a distinct knowledge there. It's a distinct knowledge beyond the knowledge that I've got when I'm still just thinking and considering. I say yes, then there's something known. The metaphysical term for that is act. Again, taking the Aristotelian Thomist term, putting it into this context. Act denotes the component of proportionate being to be known by uttering the virtually unconditioned yes of reasonable judgment. It follows that potency, form, and act constitute a unity, for they are the contents of the three levels of cognitional activity. Experiencing knows potency, understanding knows form, judgment knows act. And single knowledge combines the three. The three levels of cognitional activity yield a single knowing. What is experienced is what is understood, what is understood is what is affirmed. The three components unite in a single proportionate being. You can talk about one being known this way, but you can also talk about situations being known this way. And there's a whole speculation in some of Lauderman's work about group potency, group form, and group act to give us the metaphysical knowledge of social situations and so on. He doesn't go too far in exploring it. There's a lot more that can be done with it. I'm in agreement with Fred Kroll on this. It's found in early materials of Lauderman, speculating not only about what in this chapter he calls conjugate and central potency form and act, but also group act, to enable us to understand in metaphysical terms the concrete plurality of objective situations. So it follows then that the three components unite. The specification of their unity derives from knowing form. What is it that I know? Well, it's form. That answers the what question. And at this time in history, until we know everything about everything, which will only be is an eschatological reality, our knowledge of form, for the most part, in the majority of cases, remains provisional. Experience neither defines nor specifies; it merely presents. Judgment neither defines nor specifies; it merely affirms or denies what has been defined or specified already. All defining and specifying occur on the level of understanding. And so the unity constituted by potency, form, and act has but a single definition or specification, and that is gone from that is reached when he knows. I'm gonna give your question a little bit more time before I get to it. Let's get him first. What he's got here. The question has to be considered. It actually its major exposition is in terms of the ontology of meaning, which is the subject of chapter 17. So at this point, in chapter 17, he'll be talking about potency, form, and act in meaning, right? And in the evolution of meaning, the emergent probability of meaning. The elemental meaning is here. Okay? It's potency in the world of meaning, potency for form, and so on. Maybe that's enough for now, and we can do more of it when we get into 17. Because that's a big thing, the ontology of meaning is Hegel and Lonergan are the only two people that have ever written an ontology of meaning in any major sense. You know, so it's not exactly household word. Yes, Chris.
Just with a clarification on the content of potency, individuality, continuity, convention. Are we talking about a unity, identity, whole there?
There's going to be a division here on this. There's going to be a division into central and conjugate. This is form and act. And central and conjugate form, central conjugate potency, central conjugate form, central and conjugate act, central, except central and conjugate. All right, now, the one that he discusses first is conjugate, and then central. But you asked it in terms of central. So we have two kinds of understanding that function in explanatory knowing. We have the understanding that resulted in our knowledge of explanatory conjugates. which are known in laws that relate the elements of things to one another. And so mass would be an instance of an explanatory conjugate in physics. Explanatory conjugates now become conjugate forms. So conjugate forms are the explanatory conjugates known when one grasps that kind of intelligibility in the sciences, of the relations of things to one another. And then we have an understanding that grasps unity, identity, whole. The grasp of the unity identity whole, or the grasp of what makes something a unity identity whole, is the grasp of central theory. We have, up to this point in this course, grasped something of the central form of a human being. When we said, I am a unity identity whole constituted by operations of experiencing, understanding, and judging. That is part of what makes me the unity identity whole, that makes me who I am, that makes me different from any other kind of any other being in any other genus. So that's the central form. Central form is what grasps the unity identity whole. Central form is what Aristotle and Aquinas called substantial form. Lonergan wants to avoid the term substantial form because substance has come to mean something like it already down there now, and it doesn't mean that. It means a unity. Aristotle and Aquinas didn't mean that. They didn't mean something under. They meant what is one. Okay. So the substantial form in Christian eschatology is what survives death. Okay. The I that says I am a unity identity whole constituted by these operations, that's part of the reality. It's not the total reality. It's part of the reality that in Christian faith we affirm survives death. It's the I, the central form, is what produces. So that's that. But the conjugate form would be, for instance, all of the intellectual habits that you have already. Those are all conjugate forms. All of the habits of will that you have already, that you have developed. Okay. Now they enter into the definition of who you are, but they're not. They are not their properties. All right, now. Your question was about potency. Individuality is potency for central form because it's potency for the unity identity whole. You've got to have this, that, and the other thing. Take the hawk, the illudin, so on. You've got to have that. That's individuality. So that's conjugate potency. Oh, sorry, pardon me, central potency. It's potency for central form. And all of these continuity, conjunction, succession, non-systematic divergence are potency for the emergence of new conjugates. Okay. Now, as new conjugates form, they differentiate new types of being, and we'll have new central forms emerging. Mm-hmm. But you can have conjugates emerging before you've got central form emerging. You can have coincidental emergences of life in the universe without yet having what you would call things defined by those conjugates. Life emerges and then it vanishes. You don't have a thing defined by that. You only have a thing defined by it when you've got a sequence of a scheme of occurrence.
So these properties of potency that contribute to or correspond with the conjugate form, are they then... can they pertain to statistical and classical?
That's exactly the point of the whole thing. This is taking emergent probability and moving it into metaphysics. So it's taking classical and statistical. Okay, so this is all what he gave us by the end of chapter 4 on emergent probability and the statistical. Like this is a non-systematic divergence from probabilities is potency for the emergence of something new, okay? Mm-hmm. So, life here, life there, life here, life there, and all of a sudden life starts. And then you've got it's potency for the emergence of something systematic, schematic, schemes of occurrence. Okay? And then at this level, you have two kinds of act. Central act is existence, because it's things that exist. Okay? Properly speaking, things are what exist, unity, identity, whole. And conjugate act is occurrence. The occurrence of this, that, or the other so that we can say that schemes occur and schemes recur. Okay? So the conjugate act is the act of schemes. Schemes occur and recur. So occurrence is conjugate act. Schemes don't, properly speaking, exist. In the most proper sense of the word exist, this is the Aristotelian thing, existence is properly said of Socrates and Chris Jacobs Vandergeer and Bob Doran and you, things properly are said to exist. And other things exist in a qualified sense. Affirmation of existence is the existence of unity. Mm-hmm. So that's the breakdown there. So you've got act form. Your question pushed me, which is the next thing that we want to take away, the emergence of the division into central and conjugate. Are we on the same page? Is it, this is not easy.
I'm just kidding. Huh? I'm thinking now of, it might be a bit off topic, but I'm thinking of what somebody like Girard would say when it comes to the description of the human person, where the human person is only known through relationships. So in a way, he's saying that the human person is only known in following that scheme, not as unity, identity, whole, but more as...
Yeah. I think one of the big questions that I want to explore with Girard is whether all desire is mimetic. And is the desire to know, is that to be explained in terms of the triangular structure of mimetic desire? I don't know. There is something that awakens it in us through personal relations. You know, I mean, teachers awaken it in people. But it's latent there. It's ready. It's dormant. It's ready to break forth. And does it necessarily unfold into the triangular structure of his scapegoating and all of that sort of thing? So, Girard, as I understand him, and I've got I'm going to teach the course next year, but it's going to be much more seminar fashion than this because I want to read it with people. There are three parts to this, as I understand it. There's the mimetic desire. And he says all desire is mimetic. And that's the one question that I have. I'm not yet convinced of that in him. And then that, the scapegoating mechanism that can lead to when institutions face a crisis. And then the affirmation that he came to when in his conversion, which his conversion happened as a result of his study. His affirmation that in the gospel, all of this dynamic is exposed for what it is and overcome. Now, I think on 2 and 3, he's absolutely right. Scapegoating does take place, and that it is better for one man to die for the sake of the nation. That's precisely what happened. Jesus was scapegoated for the problems that the institution was experiencing at its core. And he became the scapegoat for it. But in his death and resurrection, the whole mechanism is exposed for what it is and overcome. I think he's absolutely right on those two. Is all desire competitive by Mises? Or is it only acquisitive desire that's my question. Is all desire acquisitive? I don't. When Lonergan speaks of a pure desire, is there the possibility? Is there such a thing? Pure desire that is not acquisitive, that simply wants things for their own sake, and what it wants are spiritual realities, meaning for its own sake, truth for its own sake, beauty for its own sake, goodness for its own sake. Not in the interest of anything else.
In
not,
a way,
not, no hidden agendas.
in a way, what Lonergan is talking about would unknot that desire.
That's right.
Because if you are truly attentive and truly understand, you can see beyond
right.
it. And when you see beyond it, then you don't fall into the trap.
That's where I'm at right now in terms of Girard. But it's really the only serious question that I have about the overall theoretical structure of his work. I'm not sure about the details of his anthropological research. I'm not qualified to pass judgment on some of the things that he studied much more than I have. But the theoretical structure is bang on, except for that number one, that he may universalize this a little bit more than is justified. That's the only point that I have. But it's an incredible thing that he's done. Understanding of the significance of the gospel. Does that help? Or at least address the issue?
It does partly, because what I'm understanding from what you're saying is that your question is precisely that perhaps the human person is not just formed in relationship, but that there is also something else.
There's something to be formed. You know. It's potency for.
For
being formed in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
We are born with a desire that comes alive only as it's prompted through presentations and so on and so forth. But it comes alive very early. The endless questions that the 2-year-old can ask. Endless. On and on, and they're real questions, you know, because they want to know. They want to know how to use words, they want to know what this is, what that is. Question why probably emerges a little bit later, but the what question is there in the descriptive form anyway, very, very early on. What is this? What's going on? Right?
On that topic also, how about sibling rivalry? It begins with children very, very early.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things that Girard uses in terms of talking about mimetic desire. Right? Sibling rivalry. He does. Anyway, how do we... No, it's very important stuff. But we got this. We got this. Enough to pursue it.
Thank you.
Let's take a break then. It's 3 o'clock. Back around 10.